need to take a shower when I look at you. You sting and hurt like a bad tattoo. I wish you'd change my point of view. I cruise the canyon to get some breeze with hidden treasures up my sleeve. I like the light and hate the heat, but I'll lick the blood right off your street. Yeah,
it was late in December, the sky turned to snow. All around the day was going down slow. Night like a river beginning to flow. I felt the beat of my mind go drifting. Time passed.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
With less than 90 days now to go before the start of the Democratic National Convention, the city of Boston is no closer to new contracts with more than 30 unions representing a variety of city workers. It's especially anxious to settle with the police department, but Mayor Thomas Menino and the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association both describe the other as stubborn, especially on issues of wages. Informational picketing about the impasse begins today outside the Fleet Center, where the DNC will take place, and larger protests are expected during next month's U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting there.
150 Texas City workers went on strike at Sterling Chemicals plant Monday, resisting attempts by the company to change their contract language. Sterling is seeking the unilateral right to replace union workers with contractors. Ruben Hernandez is the business representative for the Texas City Metal Trades Council, Local 347. He says the strike isn't about wages, even though the new contract would only guarantee a pay increase for 50% of employees.
Contract is not the best contract in the world. There's a lot of issues in that contract that we could strike on. But we understand that we could live with that contract for another 3 years. And all we're looking for is trying to make sure that our union stays in that plant and that we're not replaced by contractors.
Over 500 people work at the site, with approximately 180 represented by the union.
A setback for telecommuters who find themselves in a kind of double tax limbo. Many telecommuters work in one state, but their employers in another. And depending on state law, a telecommuter may be responsible for paying taxes on their income to both states unless they can prove that they're working out of state at the convenience of their employer. A federal appeals court ruled recently that a Tennessee man working for a company in New York is responsible for paying income taxes in both states and must claim 100% of his income for purposes of taxation in both. Just last week, the Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal to a case involving a worker in Connecticut whose income is also double taxed by New York. Only federal legislation will fix this dilemma. In the meantime, advocates of telecommuting fear its environmental friendliness and added flexibility won't be taken advantage of if people shy away of the option because of a tax burden. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Has George W. Bush delivered on his 2000 campaign pledge to run the government more like a business? New reports from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and Office of Personnel Management show that the federal workforce grew by a net 70,000 since Bush took office. And these numbers don't even count contractors who now compete for federal work. Of the 12 million people who work in some capacity for the federal government, less than 2 million are actually employed by government agencies.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find AMIBA online at amiba.net.
Wouldn't you be a little skeptical if you took your car in for a routine checkup and the repair shop said it had found a mysterious and costly problem deep in the engine that, quote, needs fixing, even though you can't detect any problem at all? Welcome to the shady world of today's Social Security mechanics, including politicos of both parties and a phalanx of banking lobbyists. They're telling us in the direst terms that there's a major problem deep in the Social Security system that must be fixed right away. The fix is going to be costly, they solemnly inform us. It'll require raising people's retirement age to as high as 70, cutting the monthly payments for all retired workers, and even privatizing part or all of this public safety net for retirees. But we must accept these fixes, they warn, or the whole system will sputter and die. BS alert, BS alert. Of all government programs, including the bloated, fraud-ridden Pentagon, Social Security is least in need of fixing. It's the most efficient program we have, requiring a mere 1% of its total budget for administrative costs. And even the political mechanics who want to mess with the program admit that Social Security is perfectly sound and capable of paying full benefits to future retirees through at least 2042. What insurance company or bank can make that claim? And with only minor adjustment, the system is solid through 2075, long after most of today's fixers will be dead. There is one fix, however, that would guarantee the soundness of Social Security in perpetuity. Raise the current $88,000 income cap so that the salaries, bonuses, stock gains, and other wealth of the elites are also subject to Social Security taxes, rather than keeping the burden solely on the wages of low-income and middle-class working folks. This is Jim Hightower saying, to push for this simple and fair reform, call Campaign for America's Future, 202-955-5665.
Toyota owners, tired of paying high gas prices? Well, how about paying nothing? That's right. Toyota is giving away free gas for a year to 12 lucky winners. Plus, 1,000 more will win $50 fill-ups. Just come into your participating Toyota dealer to enter the sweepstakes. You'll get the very best competitively priced service performed by Toyota-trained technicians using genuine Toyota parts. Come in today and ask about our May tire and service offers.
No purchase necessary. Ends May 31st, 2004. Void or prohibited. Open to legal U.S. residents 18 or older with valid driver's license only. Void in Hawaii. Official rules at Toyota.com/owners.
The following is sildenafil by Pfizer and Viagra, sildenafil citrate.
Mark Martin makes the turn. Oh, what a good move by the 33-time NASCAR race winner. The Viagra car takes the inside track. Good move!
See, I know a little something about making good moves. And one of the best moves you can make is to talk to your doctor and ask if Viagra is right for you.
Joe makes the turn. Now he's parallel parking. Wow, what a move! He's in front of his doctor's office.
Ask your doctor about a free Viagra sample today.
He's the man who uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live coast to coast on terrestrial radio stations from California to North Carolina, streaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite system, beaming around the planet on radiopower.org, showing up oddly on cable TV systems, on cable TV radio network, and with archives at WhiteRoseSociety.org. You can find it all at TomHartman.com. In fact, our chat room is starting to fill up. An interesting discussion, should we use tomorrow's National Day of Prayer, which was actually declared way back when by Harry Truman, to pray for the ouster of George W. Bush? Is that an appropriate use of a National Day? Well, we'll talk about it tomorrow. In our first half hour here, anyway, I want to get into the question of what sort of world should we be building? What is an appropriate vision of the world, and what is the vision of the world that the cons, the conservatives and the neocons, and the Bush administration by and large have? And for that, I am very pleased to have on the program with me George Monbiot, who George is the author of Manifesto for a New World Order, which defines in some regards what a new world might be like. He's the winner of the 1995 United Nations Global 500 Award. And a regular writer for The Guardian. I for years have been, George, reading your pieces on commondreams.org, always reprints them, and in The Guardian. And the breadth of your work, it just astounds me. I'm very honored to have you on the program. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Show.
Thanks very much, Tom, and it's a real pleasure to be on it.
Thank you. But, and also, if any of our listeners want to drop in, our number is 1-866-889-8894. George, let's start out with you noted today many of the most important issues facing us: climate change, international debt, nuclear proliferation, war, the balance of trade between nations can be resolved only at the global or international level. And yet this administration seems dedicated to thumbing our nose at the rest of the world, alienating our enemies, and creating an insular and, I would even say, paranoid America, xenophobic America. Is that, you're British, and I'm confident that you have a view of America that is a little larger than that of just Americans. Is that how America is seen by the world? Is that how the Bush administration is seen?
Well, let's make a distinction between those two things, America and the Bush administration. That's certainly how the Bush administration is seen. There's no question about that. And Bush is regarded as almost a self-blinded isolationist. And the way, certainly the way I see this, is that if you are to seek to govern the rest of the world, to seek to establish empire, you have almost to shut your eyes to the impact that your policies have on other people. Because if you open your eyes, if you look at what's going on, if you actually see what you are doing, it's very hard to sustain the confidence in the crazy policies which you're imposing on people. So there's almost a deliberate turning away from the implications of U.S. policy by the Bush administration.
In many ways, isn't that what happened in your country? Probably not within your memory, but when Gandhi rose up and allowed the world to see the explicit and implicit brutality of British policies in India.
Yes, and you see, what's very interesting, in both cases, we've got a propaganda machine under colonial rule, not just in India, but in sub-Saharan Africa, in many parts of the world, and of course the British had a very large empire. The British people were effectively prevented from finding out what was going on. And in fact, it's only today that we're beginning to hear about the full extent of the famines engineered in India by the British colonialists. And something very similar seems to happen here. We have a mass media controlled by a bunch of billionaires, the billionaires for Bush, who want to keep things as they are. They want to make this an even better world for billionaires, but of course a better world for billionaires by definition is a worse world for everybody else. So they have to fool us. They have to hoodwink us. They have perpetually to distract our attention from what's really happening. They have perpetually to create a false, fabricated view of the world so that we imagine that what is good for them is also good for us. And this is the way in which empire blinds itself.
And they have an entire legion. I mean, they've got hordes of well-paid shills out there. People, you know, in faux news, the right-wing talk show industry. I mean, it's just this huge machine promoting the idea that you too, Mr. Walmart worker, if we can just get these tax cuts big enough, you too have an opportunity to become a millionaire or a billionaire. You can be Donald Trump someday, ignoring the fact that Donald Trump was born a multimillionaire. His father was a real estate mogul.
Well, of course, what we've seen, and the figures show this very clearly now in the U.S., is an absolute locking in of economic position. What's happening in the U.S. today is very much what was the case in Britain 200 years ago, that those who are rich stay rich. Those who are at the top of the political tree stay at the top of the political tree. It's almost a hereditary principle being reestablished here in this great democracy. How could this possibly be the case? How is it that the U.S. has been dragged so far away from that wonderful, radical, democratic tradition which founded this great nation, which was the thing which made the U.S. the hope for the entire world? How come it now looks like Britain looked in 1750?
Yeah, Dickens documented it well. I mean, you know, it's in the Victorian era, that. The poor staying poor, and we are. And there was a report actually just a few weeks ago. Maybe you wrote it. I remember reading it. That at no time in the history of the United States has social mobility between economic classes been lower than it is right now? In other words, it's harder right now than any time in 227 years since this country was founded for a person to move from poverty into the middle class or from the middle class into the wealthy classes.
That's right. The land of opportunity has become the land of closed doors. And, you know, in Britain, we still live to some extent under the aristocratic legacy, with all the disastrous consequences which that has for our country. And it breaks my heart to see the US going in the same direction. And Bush and his gang, although it long predates Bush, but the whole corporate aristocracy in this country is taking America back to an age in which the poor become so poor that they are little better than slaves, and in which the rich remain so rich that they are pretty well at the level of monarchs and emperors.
This is remarkable. You note that simply scrapping existing institutions will not be enough to change this. So what are you talking about?
Well, I mean, my book, which is just out this week in the U.S., is what it's attempting to do is to say, what would a fair world order look like? What would a fair global set of institutions look like? Because it seems to me we desperately do need global institutions, as you were saying, to deal with these issues like climate change, like international debt, like nuclear proliferation, like war. But at the moment, the ones we've got are about as undemocratic as they could possibly be. We have a UN which has 191 members, but it's completely controlled by five of those members, the permanent members of the Security Council. We have a World Bank and IMF which are run on that time-honored democratic democratic principle of $1, one vote, which means that they are exclusively controlled by the rich nations, but they operate largely in the poor nations, and the poor nations have no way of changing the way they operate. We have a World Trade Organization, which is perpetually co-opted by the powerful countries. This is, if you look at the world today, at the global system as it stands, it's very much like the old aristocratic system in Europe before democracy.
But this is
self-appointed people, self-appointed rich and powerful people telling everyone else what to do.
Yeah, I mean this is the conservative agenda, though. I mean this is the process that the United States went through in the 1880s through 1910, the Gilded Age, and that Ronald Reagan brought back in 1980, when the corporate elite, as it were, took over the Republican Party again and kind of snatched it back from Dwight Eisenhower and Nelson Rockefeller's faction and radicalized it and this what you're describing to many people in America, you know, all those people who are, you know, all the ditto heads out there, is how it should be. They're saying, yep, that's how we maintain global dominance. That's how we keep ourselves safe. We're so powerful that anybody who rises up will crush their heads. We're tough. We drive our trucks so we don't care about SUV gas mileage. We're America.
Yeah. Well,
I'm serious.
And of course, you know, the weird thing is that the more you assert your power, the more vulnerable you become.
But see, George Bush is running on this. I mean, the subtext to his campaign is, we don't need this, you know, those stinking countries in the rest of the world. We don't need any international coalition. We don't, you know, it's okay if we're importing half our oil. It doesn't matter. We'll just go to war with another country if they've got more oil and we need it.
And then, of course, he has to go cap in hand to the United Nations and say, please bail us out of Iraq.
Well, it's interesting. You know, John Kerry suggested that last year. George Bush ridiculed it, and all of his minions across right-wing radio made fun of it for 5-6 months. And now Bush is doing it, and he's attacking Kerry for saying, gee, Kerry's saying that we should do what I'm doing.
Yes. Well, I mean, the whole problem we've got is that if you assert your splendid isolation and you assert your power and you assert your strength and you keep doing so, all you do is to alienate everyone else on Earth, and sooner or later you're going to need those other people.
Yeah.
Already Bush needs those other people in Iraq. That's very clear. The U.S. being in very serious trade deficit, very serious international debt, wholly dependent now on capital transfers from the Far East.
Principally China.
Needs the rest of the world, especially China.
Yeah.
And this is
a dictatorship!
There's this constant assertion of this idea that we're going it alone, we're an independent nation, we don't need anyone's help, and yet this utter dependency. It's a sort of huge welfare state, effectively, totally dependent on foreign capital remittances.
Yeah.
And so it just doesn't figure. I mean, it's just pure rhetoric. It's pure propaganda on Bush's part. But actually, the reality is that the U.S. is more dependent on the rest of the world than it's been at any time in its independent history.
Well, the IMF recently issued a warning about our deficits, both our trade deficits and our internal deficits, which aren't internal because they're being financed largely by external funding, saying, you know, we were risking going down the road Argentina went down. I mean, this is very real.
Well, and that is, that's a very real possibility. And another thing which is sort of lurking over the horizon, but no one seems to be taking seriously at the moment, is the fact that the world's oil reserves are very rapidly being depleted. And a lot of independent geologists and geophysicists, serious full-on scientists, and I'm beginning to say 10, 15 years at the outside, and then global demand for oil outstrips global supply. The price goes through the roof,
right.
$100, $200, $300 a barrel. And from that point on, everyone is in very serious trouble.
Yeah.
And if a country is massively overextended in terms of debt, overextended in terms of deficits, overextended militarily, is going to find itself in very, very serious trouble when that comes up.
As we are. We're speaking with George Monbiot, the author of Manifesto for a New World Order and a regular contributor to The Guardian. And we'll be right back. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Stay tuned.
I guess I better let the dog in.
Like the small dog that rules the house, Small Dog Electronics is the small computer company that really rules when it comes to customer service. Small Dog Electronics is your authorized Apple reseller in Wakefield, Vermont. Sure, you can buy your computer out of a catalog, but how do you know you're really getting what you want or what you need? At Small Dog, they don't work on commission. Their only motivation is making sure you're a happy customer. Put your business on the leading edge with the world's fastest computer, the new Macintosh G5. You'll finish the job ahead of the pack, and automatic security updates lock out viruses. That's speed and dependability that will keep you focused on your customers instead of sitting on hold with tech support.
I guess you want to get on the couch, huh?
Like the small dog who everybody makes room for, Small Dog Electronics is big on customer service. Small Dog Electronics. Check them out on the web at smalldog.com. Or at their showroom on Route 100 in Waitsfield.
No way. You're not getting on the bed.
While the world seems to be collapsing around us, there is hope. Tom Hartman's inspiring book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late, has just been re-released. The new updated version is available now and offers solutions to the issues that concern us most: eco-damage, genetic engineering, virulent disease, the end of cheap oil, water shortages, global famine, wars. We can still do something about it and create a world that will work for us and our children's children. As the inspiration for Leonardo DiCaprio's web movie, Global Warning, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight details what is happening to our planet, the reason for our culture's blind behavior, and how we can fix the problem. There is information. There is hope. The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, The Fate of the World and What We Can Do Before It's Too Late. Now with new updated information. Available in bookstores everywhere.
Pine River, Michigan, where the abandoned Velsicol plant leaks cancer-causing chemicals into the water. It's a danger neighbors will be living with for years to come. The Bush administration says polluters no longer have to pay to clean up the mess they leave behind. Taxpayers do. That means less money, fewer cleanups, and more families left at risk. Mr. President, there is a better way. Make polluters pay. Protect our kids and community.
Do the Republicans or the Democrats have a clear vision for America that actually includes democracy, fairness, and justice? Do the Greens or the Progressives? How can we create a shared vision of the kind of future we want for our children? This is Tom Hartman, and I'll be exploring these and many other issues with guests from a wide variety of viewpoints, as well as taking your calls.
The Tom Hartman Show, 12 p.m. till 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Setting up a radio station? Wondering what software to use? Listen to the words of Mike Chandler of WOBS in Florida talking about the TuneTracker system.
I love the software. I mean, it is rock solid. It has not burped one single time. This thing has not stopped. And I tell you, I've got some software that I run at two of my other radio stations that cost tons and tons more. One I paid, I think, $1,500 for it. And then one system, which was the Arrakis DigiLink system, I paid $15,000 for it. But this rivals my $15,000 system.
As Mike Chandler said, the TuneTracker system is rock solid. And the price? Only $349.95 for the pro version with traffic interface and only $149.95 for the original TuneTracker 2. Either way, you'll have a radio automation system that performs like systems costing thousands more. For more information, go to our website, www.tunetrackersystems.com. www.tunetrackersystems.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tin soldiers and Nixon coming, we're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming, four dead in Ohio.
Four dead in Ohio. That was yesterday, actually, in 1970. On that day yesterday, in 1970, four students shot dead at Kent State University. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 25 minutes past the hour. We're asking, what sort of world should we be living, and what sort of world does the Bush administration envision? How might those be clashing? We're talking with George Monbiot, who is the author of Manifesto for a New World Order, a new book just released. Highly recommended. He's the winner of the 1995 United Nations Global 500 Award and a writer for The Guardian of the UK, a newspaper in Great Britain. And George, I have a book coming out on July 4th from Random House called A Return to Democracy, and in that I suggest that at some level, some of the cons who are so anti-UN actually have some legitimate gripe and suggest that voting in the United Nations should be based on the democracy of the nation itself. That is, nations that don't allow their own people to vote for who represents them should not have a vote in the United Nations or should have a diminished vote. I believe that you're looking at something similar to that. What are your thoughts about what we can do in the final 4 minutes here? What can we do to create a more democratic world?
Well, sure. It starts with the UN, and indeed I got a very similar proposal that votes are weighted according to A, the country's population, and B, its degree of democratization within the UN. We get rid of the Security Council, vest its powers in the United Nations General Assembly. But that's not enough, because what the UN does is to represent nation states. It doesn't represent human beings. And what the nation states at the global level want is often very different to what their citizens want. So we need a directly elected assembly as well. We need a world parliament. I've looked at ways in which a world parliament can be built from the bottom up, a body which isn't a legislature. It doesn't try to lay down laws and enforce them. Its purpose is to hold to account all the other global bodies, and it makes use of this very powerful democratic tool called moral authority. It says we are the only institution at the global level which can claim to represent the world's people. We're the only institution with moral authority. So you either listen to us, or you don't listen to us, in which case you sacrifice any claim you might have to be a legitimate body. But it's got to go beyond that as well. I'm calling for the scrapping of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which I think are completely illegitimate institutions, and their replacement by a far superior idea, which was first proposed in 1943 by the great economist John Maynard Keynes, called the International Clearing Union. And the Clearing Union, the way that Keynes proposed it, and there is a very, very smart idea, it took him 12 years of work to develop it, what it does is to automatically completely change the way in which the global trading system operates, to have a trade organization which, first of all, allows the poorer countries to follow the routes to development which are taken by the rich countries, protecting their infant industries from competition till they're big enough to survive on their own two feet, making free use of the rich nations' intellectual property rights, but also this trade organization would become a licensing authority for multinational corporations. It would say to them, you cannot trade internationally between nations unless you can prove you're trading fairly. So in other words, the principle which informs the fair trade movement today, if you buy fair trade tea or coffee or cocoa, for example, that is applied universally to all companies operating between nations.
Extraordinary. That is an extraordinary superstructure. George Monbiot, author of Manifesto for a New World Order. George, thank you very much for being with us today.
That's my pleasure, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour.
A must-read, The Edison Gene, ADHD and the Gift of the Hunter Child by Tom Hartman, best-selling author of Attention Deficit Disorder, A Different Perception. Ed Halliwell, a nationally recognized expert on ADD, said this about The Edison Gene.
Tom Hartman demonstrates that ADHD can be associated with creativity, high achievement, and a most successful adaptive style.
The Edison Gene, now available in bookstores everywhere.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
With less than 90 days now to go before the start of the Democratic National Convention, the city of Boston is no closer to new contracts with more than 30 unions representing a variety of city workers. It's especially anxious to settle with the police department, but Mayor Thomas Menino and the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association both describe the other as stubborn, especially on issues of wages. Informational picketing about the impasse begins today outside the Fleet Center, where the DNC will take place, and larger protests are expected during next month's U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting there.
150 Texas City workers went on strike at Sterling Chemicals plant Monday, resisting attempts by the company to change their contract language. Sterling is seeking the unilateral right to replace union workers with contractors. Ruben Hernandez is the business representative for the Texas City Metal Trades Council, Local 347. He says the strike isn't about wages, even though the new contract would only guarantee a pay increase for 50% of employees.
Contract is not the best contract in the world. There's a lot of issues in that contract that we could strike on. But we understand that we could live with that contract for another 3 years. And all we're looking for is trying to make sure that our union stays in that plant and that we're not replaced by contractors.
Over 500 people work at the site, with approximately 180 represented by the union.
A setback for telecommuters who find themselves in a kind of double tax limbo. Many telecommuters work in one state, but their employers in another. And depending on state law, a telecommuter may be responsible for paying taxes on their income to both states unless they can prove that they're working out of state at the convenience of their employer. A federal appeals court ruled recently that a Tennessee man working for a company in New York is responsible for paying income taxes in both states and must claim 100% of his income for purposes of taxation in both. Just last week, the Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal to a case involving a worker in Connecticut whose income is also double taxed by New York. Only federal legislation will fix this dilemma. In the meantime, advocates of telecommuting fear its environmental friendliness and added flexibility won't be taken advantage of if people shy away of the option because of a tax burden. Here's today's Dow Bob report. Has George W. Bush delivered on his 2000 campaign pledge to run the government more like a business? New reports from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and Office of Personnel Management show that the federal workforce grew by a net 70,000 since Bush took office. And these numbers don't even count contractors who now compete for federal work. Of the 12 million people who work in some capacity for the federal government, less than 2 million are actually employed by government agencies.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I've heard that other countries are down on the U.S.
a land of mass consumption, our lives filled with excess. But my daddy wasn't fighting on Normandy that day for the right to drive a Hyundai. I refuse to live that way. And I'm proud to be an American who gets just 5 mpg. Though I live alone, the car I own can seat 103, and I'll gladly park so close to you when you pull out you can't see. No, I'll never trade my Escalade. God bless my SUV.
And welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Boy, we've got an interesting Berlusconi alert this hour. Our official Berlusconi alert music, the national anthem of Italy. As you'll recall, Silvio Berlusconi started out as a cruise ship singer, became a small businessman, some people say a small-time crook and thug, and ended up buying a TV station, then a radio station, then another radio station, then another TV station, until he reached the point where he controls 90% of the electronic media in Italy and about 70% of the print media in Italy. And then he ran for office, he and his party. And surprise, surprise, they won. Not only did they win, but here's the news of the day. Today. Silvio Berlusconi's administration becomes the longest-lasting, continuous government, longest-lasting administration. He's the longest-lasting prime minister in the history of the Italian Republic since 1946, when it was resurrected after the failed experiment with fascism put together by good old Benito Mussolini. And the Associated Press, they don't quite get this, you know. It's like all around the world, people are looking at it going, isn't this cool? Isn't it? He must be really, how did he do this? Despite public gaffes and criminal charges, billionaire premier Silvio Berlusconi enters the record books today for heading the longest surviving government in post-World War II Italy. Since the Republic was founded in 1946, the AP notes in this article by Tom Rackman, Italy has had 59 administrations lasting less than a year on average. Berlusconi's coalition, formed in June 2001, tied the record of 1,059 days in power on Tuesday. Modern Italy has never had a premier quite like Berlusconi, they go on to say. A cruise ship singer in his youth, at age 67, Berlusconi is a media tycoon who offers the public endless spectacle, from TV shows full of scantily clad dancers, this on his TV networks, to the facelift he revealed to the public earlier this year. And then they go on to say, his government's duration may seem remarkable, given the internationally publicized accusations of corruption and questions about the propriety of a premier owning the vast portion of the nation's media. Remarkable? Remarkable? What a surprise! What a surprise! Yes, indeed. Silvio Berlusconi, who would have thought that if you controlled all the media of a nation, and anybody who talked poorly about you simply got censored or bumped off the air, that you could hold on to power longer than anybody ever had in the history of a particular country. Well, Berlusconi, no doubt, an inspiration to the Bush administration and the right-wing radio machine out there, no doubt. And moving along, it's remarkable. It's time for our Berlusconi alert to our right-wing media alert.
Condescending crimes, making money, selling lies. You might say, everybody hates my guts.
Hates his guts.
I'm offensive, I'm a bigot, I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic guts.
And now we find the liberals doing what they always do, and I've told you this, they always try to give me 50 milligrams of Vicodin instead of the 80s.
I'm a Nazi.
That's right. Yes, sir. Our right-wing media alert music.
I'm a Nazi.
I don't care about the middle class.
I'm a fat conservative, butthead, with the face of a horse's ass.
He's a fat conservative, butthead, hey, the face of a horse's ass.
Yes, indeed. Here, Rush Limbaugh lied about Republicans undermining the Kosovo war effort, accusing Senator Edward Kennedy and other unnamed Democrats of undermining the nation's unity over the war on Iraq. Limbaugh, during his April 29 show, made the false claim that Republicans refrained from criticizing the war effort in Kosovo out of concern for unity. Do you get this? He's saying, oh, well, you know, when Bill Clinton went into Kosovo, Well, here's actually what he said. He said, "We have had Kosovo, which, I mean, it went without any casualties." Now, that in and of itself, by the way, is something that should give everybody pause. We invaded a country, Kosovo, and we did not lose a single soldier. Why? Because we listened to the generals. We went in with absolute overwhelming force. We planned for the peace after the war was won. It was well organized. It was well put together. It was done, of course, by the Clinton administration. So you don't hear much about the fact that not one single soldier was lost in combat during the Kosovo operation. Anyhow, Limbaugh says, "We've had Kosovo," which, I mean, it went without any casualties. There was no, you know, Republicans didn't raise a lot of hell about it, didn't try to divide the country over it. End quote. Well, my friends, here's what really happened. Republicans relentlessly criticized Clinton over his handling of Kosovo. Leading the charge was House Majority Whip Tom DeLay, who referred to the Allied operation as the Clinton War. According to the Houston Chronicle on April 20, 1999, other Republican leaders, the Chronicle reported, took to calling the Kosovo conflict the Democrat War. And House Speaker Denny Hastert even referred to U.S. military personnel involved in the NATO operation as Clinton's forces. According to the Washington Post on April 14, 1999, Senate Republican Policy Chairman Larry Craig referred to the operation in Kosovo as the Clinton-Gore War. On March 23rd, the Washington Post reported, quote, "Republicans again criticized Clinton's Kosovo policy as the Senate opened a debate on whether to demand that any airstrikes must first win congressional approval. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson, Republican of Texas, said, 'We're now picking sides in a civil war that where the United States' interests are not clear. Before we go bombing sovereign nations, we ought to have a plan.'" According to the San Jose Mercury News on April 11, 1999, quote, "Republican criticism of President Clinton's leadership in the growing Balkan War intensified when Representative Heather Wilson observed in the Republican Party's weekly radio address," quote, "Thus far, our strategy in Kosovo has failed to achieve our political objectives. The president owes the Congress a complete picture of the situation in the Balkans, the effect of the bombing, the military and non-military options available, and the risks of each. What is the vital national American interest at stake in the Balkans?" Wilson asked. According to the Associated Press on April 27, 1999, Republican Senator Bob Smith said, "The U.S. should pull out now rather than get bogged down in wars that are not winnable. I don't have a lot of confidence in the President Clinton in this matter at all." Republican Representative Charlie Bass, quote, "characterized White House policy as indecisive and confused. President needs to advise Congress as to what exactly his strategy is," end quote. No, Rush. Republicans didn't raise a lot of hell about that. They didn't try to divide the country over it. No, no. Not at all.
In closing, let me say that each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob. I'm the capo, the capo, Joe McCarthy-like Gestapo, the right-wing, foam-of-the-mouth, jack-booted slob, the democratic trasher, years of liberal bashing with the equivalent compassion of a grommet. With the IQ of a pig, I'm a fat, obnoxious pig. And the truth of the matter is, I'm vomit. Because I'm a Nazi. I really am. Because I'm a Nazi. You're being scammed. I'm a Nazi.
Enough of that. Enough of that. Okay. Our conservative alert music, Class War in America, by the way, is our book for the month. Every month we do we call it the Independent Thinker Book Club of the Month. And it's not really a book club in that, you know, you don't have to buy anything. You can buy the book anywhere you want. BuzzFlash.com, however, has a story about the book every month, a review that I write, in last month, Tim King and I wrote it together. Tim actually wrote most of it. This month I wrote the whole thing. And about a book that I've come across that I think is like, this is really something. This is a book that really helps inform people, really helps people understand issues that perhaps they've missed, perhaps they've overlooked. And our Independent Thinker Book of the Month this month is called Class War in America by Charles M. Kelly. And I encourage you, I don't know if it's up yet on BuzzFlash. I sent it to him last night. So it may be that they're still pointing to last month's book, which was How Democratic is the American Constitution by Robert Dahl. But the new one will be Class War in America. We'll be talking about that throughout the month, and we'll be coming back to that. But just wanted to give you a heads up on that, and that you can read about it at BuzzFlash.com. I'll also have a piece on CommonDreams.org today about the draft. I think you may find that interesting. 1-866-888-9894, our telephone number, if you'd like to weigh in on the issues of the day. Dave in Illinois, listening on the Sirius satellite system, is on the line. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I am also great, but I'll get better.
Okay, what's up?
You missed one quote concerning the war in Kosovo from Senator Trent Lott.
Oh, my. Okay.
I support our troops, but I don't support this president.
Gee, what a memorable... And Trent Lott said, yeah, well, you know, according to Rush, the Republicans were all fully supportive of Clinton because they didn't want to divide the country.
Yes, so. Well, I seem to, every time I use that quote now, I seem to be called a traitor.
Yeah, go figure. Thanks for sharing that with us, Dave.
Certainly.
And thanks for listening.
Thanks,
I appreciate it. Keep on trucking there. Okay, it's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 16 minutes before the hour. A story out of New London, Connecticut. This fascinating. The Associated Press reported the following case from New London, Connecticut. A man whose bid to become a police officer was rejected after he scored too high on an intelligence test has lost an appeal in his federal lawsuit against the city. The second day, here's the bottom line. They tested the applicants to be police officers, and this guy was too smart. Too smart. In 1996, Jordan scored 33 points on the police exam, which is the equivalent of an IQ of 125, well above average, but 15 points short of the traditional genius cutoff of 140. But New London police interviewed only candidates who scored 20 to 27 on the theory that those who scored too high could get bored with police work and leave soon after undergoing costly training. The AP reports that the national average for police officers is an IQ of 104, which is slightly above average. Interesting story. He's worked as a prison guard since his rejection by New London police. Apparently, prison authorities don't think he's too intelligent for a guard job, or maybe prison guards have to be smarter than police recruits. You know, the subtext of this, frankly, I don't think the cops are dumb. I wrote a series of novels back in the 80s about a private detective. And as part of the research for those books, a friend of mine, DeWitt Wanamaker, who's a private detective, owns a private detective agency in Atlanta, invited me to spend some time with him. I went on stakeouts and all kinds of weird stuff. And it was the year of the Olympics in Atlanta. And for the first time in its 137-year history, the Georgia Police Academy opened its doors to private detectives because there weren't enough cops to provide security for the Olympics in Atlanta. And so they said, okay, we got to train some. We need more trained people. And so if you were a private detective, you could go through the Georgia Police Academy's training program that was very similar to the training program they had for state police officers. And DeWitt called me up and he said, hey, you want to go through this thing? You'll end up with a certificate. You get a badge, the whole bit. Not as a state police officer, but as a full-fledged private detective. I was sort of a half-fledged at that point. And I said, sure, and DeWitt did it with me. And it was fascinating. You learn everything from hand-to-hand combat to shooting range to how to spin cars around. Using one of the things I thought was interesting, using rental cars, by the way, to do it. I remember one particularly poignant moment. DeWitt and I were sitting in the cafeteria of the Georgia Police Academy, and the cafeteria is this huge area. It's an atrium, and it's large enough that a group of 50 men can march in formation back and forth in it. And they do, on rainy days and things. And we were sitting in the cafeteria having a cup of coffee, and these guys were marching back and forth. These new recruits, they were going to become state police officers. And I said to DeWitt, how much do they pay those guys? And I don't now, it's been 10 years. I don't remember the number that he quoted me, but, what sticks in my head was that it was around $30,000, $35,000, something like that a year. But I remember my response. I said, you couldn't pay me that much to go out and get shot at. I mean, that's a tough job, being a state policeman. And DeWitt kind of chuckled, and he said, are you kidding? He said, half those guys out there, you give them a stick, a gun, tell them they can beat up whoever they want, they do the job for free. And I have to tell you that going through the academy, I remember in the hand-to-hand combat session, there was one guy, we were studying Aikido, and I flipped this one guy over, and hurt him. I mean, you know, knocked the wind out of him. And he got up, and he was dead set. He was going to punish me, and he beat me up really bad and made a big joke about it. He said, "I'm one mean mother," you know, and like that. His name was Stanley. I still remember him. And you get it that yeah, at some level, for some, you know, in some ways, there is sort of a pathological mentality that's attracted to it. But the bottom line, I think, is that when the day comes in our society that we pay our police officers and our teachers and our firefighters, those who are holding our security in their hands and those who are holding the future of our nation, our children, in their hands, that when we pay them and respect them at the level that we pay senior management in corporations, then you'll see a significant qualitative shift in the nature of the United States, in the nature of the quality of life in our country. I'm just absolutely convinced of that. And I did meet some truly brilliant people in the Georgia Police Academy. So there's some really great cops out there, very intelligent guys who are working for men and women, who are working for way too little money, in my opinion. And you know, with increased salaries, of course, you could have increased accountability, and then you're not going to have another Rodney King incident. So, anyhow, my 2 cents worth on that. I think it's a shame this guy's IQ is too high for the New Haven or New London, Connecticut Police Department. Tom Hartman radio program, 10 minutes before the hour, exposing the con and conservative. Stick around, we'll be right back.
Are you frustrated by your constant inability to lose weight? Are you looking for a natural, clinically proven weight loss breakthrough? Introducing CarboBlocker. Unlike anything else on the market, CarboBlocker is backed by clinical research that proves it effectively helps block the fattening effects of carbs without stimulants. Your body will think you're eating a low-carb diet even when you're not. The results are simply amazing. If you want to maintain the weight loss effects of low-carb dieting for the long run, if you're tired of clothes that are too tight and you want to look fit and sexy, then CarboBlocker is for you. It's clinically effective. Formula is safe, natural, and stimulant-free. And as a special introductory offer, when you order 2 bottles of Carbo Blocker, you'll get 2 bottles of Appetite Blocker absolutely free. Call in the next 10 minutes, and you'll also receive 2 free books, Lose Fat Now and the Low Carb Cookbook, a $100 value, absolutely free. So call now, 1-800-743-5704. Guaranteed to work or your money back, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. That's 1-800-743-5704.
How can contemporary America possibly compare with 1933 Germany? Find out in Tom Hartman's brand new fully illustrated book, We the People, A Call to Take Back America. Through Tom's concise political analysis and Neil Cohn's vibrant illustrations, you'll observe an unsettling, if not shocking, perspective of America. You'll also hear what the founders of this country did to control corporate power. You'll be invited to consider how the American political system can be made more democratic, as well as comprehend the project for the new American century's vision for America. Here's what syndicated cartoonist Ted Rawl said after reading We the People.
An ambitious effort to explain everything that's wrong in America, how things got this way, and what should be done about it. We the People is the product of a brilliant and principled thinker.
We the People, A Call to Take Back America by Tom Hartman. Available in bookstores everywhere.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitzky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order 2 bottles of Dr. Toplitzky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get 2 bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores? Call now. 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
virus that causes AIDS might throw some developing countries into social turmoil. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Countries with large populations of HIV-positive citizens face years of social unrest and violence. That's the view of Robert Engelman, a vice president of the nonprofit group Population Action International.
HIV/AIDS really kills large numbers of people in the middle-aged population, and it leaves young people behind, so there's an even greater proportion of young people, sometimes called a youth bulge.
Engelman's group has found that countries with a youth bulge, large numbers of people between the ages of 15 and 29, are more prone to social conflict.
Our theory is that it changes the age structure in unprecedented ways. It's more the younger, middle-aged people who die from the disease. So the people who are dying of AIDS in a country that is really ravaged by this disease typically are in their most productive years. They're people in their 30s, people in their 40s, some people in their 50s. It artificially increases the youth bulge, which is something that we've documented is highly correlated with conflict.
Engelman says HIV/AIDS is hitting hardest in countries that already suffer from poverty and social unrest.
It artificially boosts the youth bulge that already exists in many of these societies, and it deprives the societies of leadership. And it just suggests that there's going to be increasing problems providing jobs, maintaining economic development, and keeping a stable society.
Engelman says more generous assistance in the fight against HIV/AIDS can help address the health of individuals and whole societies. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
The Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
You know, some things in life are bad. They can really make you mad. And other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. This'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life.
Oh, yeah. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Always look on the bright side of life. You know, it really beats the alternative. It really just does. Very straightforward. Have you seen this piece? It's floating around the Internet. Harry G. Levine, I'm not sure how he pronounces it, Ralph Nader's suicide bomber. He went to a rally on October 13th of 2000 at Madison Square Garden, a Nader rally. And, you know, Nader was giving his speech about corporate power, blah-de-blah, and how George Bush and Al Gore were Tweedledum and Tweedledee, that they look the same, they act the same, no matter what, you get it. And he says, I went home angry, but it took me a while to understand that my progressive hero had turned suicide bomber, that Ralph Nader had strapped political dynamite onto himself and walked into one of the closest elections in American history hoping to blow it up. The next day, Michael Levine writes, I was invited to a fundraising party in Greenwich Village. There I approached Michael Moore and described how the campaign could use the web to provide the latest data on battleground states like Florida, where Nader supporters should hold their noses and vote for Gore. When Moore realized what I was suggesting, he puffed up like one of those fish that expand when threatened, leaned into me, poked his finger into my face, and yelled, You can't say that! You can't say that! You can't say that! Later, I was introduced to Nader's closest advisor, his handsome, piercingly intelligent 30-year-old nephew, Tarek Milleron. Although Milleron argued that environmentalists and other activists would fundraise easier again under Bush, he acknowledged that a Bush presidency would be worse for poor and working-class people, for blacks, for most Americans. As Moore had, however, he claimed that Nader's campaign would encourage web-based vote swapping between progressives and safe and contested states. But when I suggested that Nader could gain substantial influence in a Democratic administration by focusing his campaign on the 40 safe states and encouraging his supporters elsewhere to vote for Gore, now get this, Milleron leaned coolly toward me with extra steel in his voice and body. He did not disagree. He simply said, we're not going to do that. Why not, I said. With just a flicker of a smile, he answered, because we want to punish the Democrats. We want to hurt them, wound them. There was a long silence, and the conversation was over. From Ralph Nader's Suicide Bomber by Harry G. Levine, published in various parts of the Internet May 3rd, 2004. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, News Without Conflicts of Global Corporate Interest.
Been listening to the Tom Hartman program? Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. They're imported from France. They're certified eco-friendly, and they're reasonably priced. What am I talking about? Eco Wines. One of the best-kept secrets in America, Eco Wines from the south of France. Brought to you since 1980 by my company, the Organic Wine Company. My name is Véronique. I select these earth-friendly wines personally. They are made with organic grapes. They burst with life and flavor. Our number? Easy to remember. 1-888-ECO-WINE. Our site? Easy to find. EcoWine.com. See, if you're going to eat, eat organic. If you're going to drink, drink wisely. Drink organic. Our future depends on it. Remember our number? 1-888-ECO-WINE. And that is ECOWINE.
Pop and not-so-pop culture, democracy, and the news of the day. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner.
With less than 90 days now to go before the start of the Democratic National Convention, the city of Boston is no closer to new contracts with more than 30 unions representing a variety of city workers. It's especially anxious to settle with the police department, but Mayor Thomas Menino and the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association both describe the other as stubborn, especially on issues of wages. Informational picketing about the impasse begins today outside the Fleet Center, where the DNC will take place, and larger protests are expected during next month's U.S. Conference of Mayors meeting there.
150 Texas City workers went on strike at Sterling Chemicals plant Monday, resisting attempts by the company to change their contract language. Sterling is seeking the unilateral right to replace union workers with contractors. Ruben Hernandez is the business representative for the Texas City Metal Trades Council, Local 347. He says the strike isn't about wages, even though the new contract would only guarantee a pay increase for 50% of employees.
Contract is not the best contract in the world. There's a lot of issues in that contract that we could strike on. But we understand that we could live with that contract for another 3 years. And all we're looking for is trying to make sure that our union stays in that plant and that we're not replaced by contractors.
Over 500 people work at the site, with approximately 180 represented by the union.
A setback for telecommuters who find themselves in a kind of double tax limbo. Many telecommuters work in one state, but their employers in another. And depending on state law, a telecommuter may be responsible for paying taxes on their income to both states unless they can prove that they're working out of state at the convenience of their employer. A federal appeals court ruled recently that a Tennessee man working for a company in New York is responsible for paying income taxes in both states and must claim 100% of his income for purposes of taxation in both. Just last week, the Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal to a case involving a worker in Connecticut whose income is also double taxed by New York. Only federal legislation will fix this dilemma. In the meantime, advocates of telecommuting fear its environmental friendliness and added flexibility won't be taken advantage of if people shy away of the option because of a tax burden. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Has George W. Bush delivered on his 2000 campaign pledge to run the government more like a business? New reports from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and Office of Personnel Management show that the federal workforce grew by a net 70,000 since Bush took office. And these numbers don't even count contractors who now compete for federal work. Of the 12 million people who work in some capacity for the federal government, less than 2 million are actually employed by government agencies.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Think you're not involved in your community? Think again. Spending your money with local businesses is more than an economic choice. It's a way you can have a say in the look and feel of your hometown. By creating a demand for local goods and services, we can ensure a place for the independent businesses that help give our communities character and keep them unique. The American Independent Business Alliance encourages you to get involved. Support your homegrown businesses. Find Amoeba online at amiba.net.
Wouldn't you be a little skeptical if you took your car in for a routine checkup and the repair shop said it had found a mysterious and costly problem deep in the engine that, quote, needs fixing, even though you can't detect any problem at all? Welcome to the shady world of today's Social Security mechanics, including politicos of both parties and a phalanx of banking lobbyists. They're telling us in the direst terms that there's a major problem deep in the Social Security system that must be fixed right away. The fix is going to be costly, they solemnly inform us. It'll require raising people's retirement age to as high as 70, cutting the monthly payments for all retired workers, and even privatizing part or all of this public safety net for retirees. But we must accept these fixes, they warn, or the whole system will sputter and die. BS alert, BS alert. Of all government programs, including the bloated, fraud-ridden Pentagon, Social Security is least in need of fixing. It's the most efficient program we have, requiring a mere 1% of its total budget for administrative costs. And even the political mechanics who want to mess with the program admit that Social Security is perfectly sound and capable of paying full benefits to future retirees through at least 2042. What insurance company or bank can make that claim? And with only minor adjustment, the system is solid through 2075, long after most of today's fixers will be dead. There is one fix, however, that would guarantee the soundness of Social Security in perpetuity. Raise the current $88,000 income cap so that the salaries, bonuses, stock gains, and other wealth of the elites are also subject to Social Security taxes, rather than keeping the burden solely on the wages of low-income and middle-class working folks. This is Jim Hightower saying, to push for this simple and fair reform, call Campaign for America's Future, 202-955-5665.
Toyota owners, tired of paying high gas prices? Well, how about paying nothing? That's right. Toyota is giving away free gas for a year to 12 lucky winners. Plus, 1,000 more will win $50 fill-ups. Just come into your participating Toyota dealer to enter the sweepstakes. You'll get the very best competitively priced service performed by Toyota-trained technicians using genuine Toyota parts. Come in today and ask about our May tire and service offers.
No purchase necessary. Ends May 31st, 2004. Void or prohibited. Open to legal U.S. residents 18 or older with valid driver's license only. Void in Hawaii. Official rules at Toyota.com/owners.
The following is sponsored by Pfizer and Viagra, sildenafil citrate.
Mark Martin makes the turn. Oh, what a good move by the 33-time NASCAR race winner. The Viagra car takes the inside track. Good move!
See, I know a little something about making good moves. And one of the best moves you can make is to talk to your doctor and ask if Viagra is right for you.
Joe makes the turn. Now he's parallel parking. Wow, what a move! He's in front of his doctor's office.
Ask your doctor about a free Viagra sample today.
Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, friends. Yesterday, we started reading 100 Mistakes. 100 Mistakes? Well, you know, George W. Bush, when he did his news conference, he said he couldn't think of any mistakes that he'd made in his three-odd years as President of the United States. Not one. Not a single one. And still hasn't. And so the Center for American Progress put together a list, pretty thoughtful actually, a very thoughtful list of 100 mistakes that George could choose from. So we're in the interest of helping him out, we will share them with him. We had gone through the first 10 yesterday. Here's the next 10. Trusting Ahmed Chalabi, who has dismissed faulty intelligence he provided the president as necessary for getting the Americans to topple Saddam. Number 12, disbanding the Sunni Baathist managers responsible for Iraq's water, electricity, sewer system, and all the other critical parts of the country's infrastructure. Number 13, failing to give UN weapons inspectors enough time to certify if weapons in fact did exist in Iraq. Boy, that's a biggie. We would have 700 of our young men and women still alive today if George Bush had simply said, okay, we'll wait another month. I mean, think about that. You would have 4,000 or 5,000 young men and women who would have their arms back, who would have their legs back, who would have their vision back or their hearing. You would have hundreds of thousands, well, tens of thousands of young American men and women who would not have been exposed to depleted uranium or the trauma of killing on the battlefield. If George W. Bush had simply said, okay, we'll go along with what all the rest of the world is asking for and give the weapons inspectors another month or two with what the United Nations is asking for. And let's just see if this country represents a threat. And if there's any evidence at all that they represent a threat, and if there, you know, if any comes forward, then we will take action. And in fact, if, according to Resolution 1440, if any evidence did come forward, the United Nations had already said, we will collectively take action. But the evidence was never found, and George went charging in anyway. Got to get that oil. Got to get reelected. Got to be a war president. His daddy pulled out of Iraq just a little too soon. They went back and they looked at the election polling results and they found out that George Herbert Walker Bush, if he had just extended the war in Iraq by 1 month, instead of having it be a three-day war, if he had made it a one-month war, he would have been elected president of the United States and Bill Clinton never would have been elected. But the bounce faded. The war was over, the bounce faded. Just like the bounce faded from Afghanistan. Well, we need another war at Iraq. Anyway. Number 14, including discredited intelligence concerning Nigerian yellowcake in his 2003 State of the Union. Number 15, announcing that major combat operations in Iraq have ended. Aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln on May 1st of last year below a mission accomplished banner. More soldiers have died in combat since his announcement than before it. Number 16, awarding a multi-billion-dollar contract to Halliburton in Iraq, which then repeatedly overcharged the government. I mean, you get the cons are all like foaming at the mouth about this UN food for oil deal, oil for food deal, and the graft and corruption. But they're not saying a word about what might be, apparently, I mean, it's already been admitted to, much larger numbers in terms of graft and corruption by our own corporations, by corporations connected, politically connected to this administration. What is it true that George Washington, after the war for independence, was the richest man in America, or was he broke? By the way, he was broke. Is the reality, and he was for the rest of his life. And he was the one, in large part, who pulled together the Constitutional Convention of 1787 to move us from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution and created the United States as it is now, and then became the first president, and still died without enough money to free all of his slaves. I mean, these folks who say, oh, you know, the United States, a bunch of rich white guys just trying to protect them, say, no, sorry. You could argue it was an upper middle class, but the real rich in America, most of them left for Canada or went back to England after the Revolutionary War. Anyhow, education is a human right regardless of station of birth, and Jefferson's idea was that every person, regardless of how much money they had, regardless of what kind of family they came from, regardless, should have available to them a free public education, which included college. In fact, he felt that college was the most important. That if somebody could qualify for college, even if they were self-educated, because keep in mind back then, many people were self-educated. Or they were taught by tutors, or they were taught by their parents. Many communities did not have schools. And yet America had the most educated populace. In 1834, when Alexis de Tocqueville came over here, visited the United States, wrote up his experiences in a book called Democracy in America, the United States had the most educated populace of all nations on earth. In part, it was because of Jefferson's ideal, his dream. He created the University of Virginia as a free college that anybody could attend. Anybody could go to this college if they simply demonstrated that they were capable of handling the curriculum. And this vision held in the United States up until Ronald Reagan became governor of California and started dismantling the University of California college university system, the last one in the United States to be a totally free college system for any members of the state. And now we have hundreds of thousands of outraged parents, students, and teachers across the country calling on George Bush to fire Rod Page, the education secretary. They delivered a petition to the White House with more than 250,000 signatures. This is the guy who was the head of the Houston School District when it had the Houston Miracle. Remember the Houston Miracle everybody's talking about in the 2000 election? No kids dropped out. Turns out it was all Enron accounting. The Houston school system was among the worst in the country, particularly the school that Rod Page had been running. And they had simply lied about and fudged their numbers. This didn't come out until last year. Got virtually no press coverage. Just amazing. Virtually none. And now you've got the Bush administration attacking teachers instead of listening to them. Going on Rod Page calling them terrorists. More than a third of the 250,000 people who signed that petition calling for Rod Page's firing were parents. Parents. They passed the hat. They raised money to run ads. And the first wave of ads are now up. Again, I don't know why this isn't in the news. I mean, this seems to me like, you know, CBS should be covering this, the evening news. They have placed ads all around. They're putting them on, you know, these print ads that they put on the back of bus stops. The first waves of ad are all up around the Department of Education's Washington headquarters on New Jersey Avenue, at 12th Street and F Streets, at 17th and H Streets, and at the Metro Center, L'Enfant Plaza, and Union Station subway stations. Fire Rod Page. The Institute for America's Future President Robert Borsage notes that the Bush administration is attacking teachers even as the president breaks his own promise to fund education reforms. John Kerry weighed in on this issue. He had two comments on this, and I thought that they were very well taken.
They're now talking flexibility because it's in the middle of an election and they know how angry people are about No Child Left Behind. But it's all been rhetoric. And they've talked about the No Child Left Behind and promptly underfunded it for several years in a row. I think Americans are forewarned. I mean, how many times do you have to be fooled before you sort of realize people aren't serious? And I don't think the Bush administration has been really serious.
Comment number one. And then he went on to say,
the fact is the president has underfunded education hugely, way behind. By $26 billion, he's underfunded what the No Child Left Behind Act should have been funded by. So a huge number of school districts are struggling with very inadequate resources to do a bigger job. And that equation doesn't work.
Entirely true. And I wish somebody would give him some Ritalin or something. You know, give this guy some speed. You know, John, he's a good guy. If he really is the most liberal member of the Senate, I will, you know, even if he's not, I will vote for him. But I will, you know, I have high hopes for him. And he's got to get some fire in his belly. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Roberta in Santa Fe is on the line. Hey, Roberta, what's up?
Morning, Tom. Well, one thing for sure, John McCain sure isn't the most liberal senator. I wanted to talk about Jefferson. I'm so glad you brought up the education thing.
That
a democracy cannot work without the education of the masses. And I wondered, and I've been wanting to ask whether that university is still solvent and there. Is it still there?
Oh, it is. It's the University of Virginia. It's very much still there and very much still solvent, but they do charge admission now.
Yeah. Well, you know, that brings up another point. I don't know where do you get the information about Washington dying broke? He married a very wealthy widow, as did Jefferson.
Yep.
And he really took charge of the military when Adams was president. You know, he retired as president, but I really think he might have been the true fascist, he and Hamilton. They were Masons. I mean, Washington was a Mason. I'm not sure about John Adams. His son, John Quincy, his precocious son, worshipped Jefferson, followed him around like a puppy dog when he was young and in France. And when John Quincy ran for president, he ran on the anti-Masonic ticket.
Right.
So I don't know.
John Quincy was more of what would today be called a Democrat. That's why you don't hear the Republicans talking too much about him.
But the thing about Washington,
if you want the information on George Washington, here's a great starting point. Gore Vidal's got a new book out about the founders, and I forget the title of it. It's something like The Founding of America or something. It's just a short little thing. It's maybe 130 pages, 150 pages, and it is absolutely brilliant. And the opening chapter, the opening paragraph, in fact. I know Louise is listening. Louise, if you would run and grab that book, I would like to share that with Roberta because it is just so brilliantly written.
Well, you know,
is about George Washington.
The fellow who wrote about John Adams, Montgomery, what was his name? He says in his book, he talks quite a lot about Jefferson, and he says that Washington, of course, was behind the pushing Adams to get into the war with France, and of course, Jefferson was against it. You know, I don't think Jefferson could have been either a Mason, a fascist, or a capitalist. And I have three reasons why. Do you want to hear them?
Well, I don't need to because I agree with you. He was none of the above.
But he was an agrarian reformer.
Yeah.
He was against the capitalism of Hamilton very much. And he died a pauper. And I don't think you can be a pauper if you are any of the aforesaid. I would submit respectfully, Tom, that he was a socialist. He coined the phrase of the people, by the people, for the people, government. That is socialism.
Yeah.
And, you know, you always...
It's all a matter of definitions, Roberta. Let me just share with you this Gore Vidal's new book, Inventing a Nation, Washington, Adams, and Jefferson. Here is the first... Let me read you the first page, the first paragraph. In the fall of 1786, the 54-year-old president of the Potomac Company, George Washington, late commander-in-chief of the American Army, resigned December 23, 1783, after 8 years of active duty, was seriously broke. Majestically, he had refused any salary from the revolutionary American government, so seldom in useful Congress assembled. But it had always been agreed that should their cause be victorious, Congress would pay the general's expenses, which it did. And they talk about that. And he says, now the general was retired to his Virginia plantation, Mount Vernon. Despite 100 slaves, Mount Vernon yielded insufficient revenue, while various western lands in the Ohio River were costing the general more than they brought in. Worse, since he was the world's most famous man, he was also the world's most visited, at home by both countrymen and wide-eyed Europeans. And then he goes on and talks about that. He says, my living under the best economy I can use, you know, and he was broke. He was broke the rest of his life. In fact, he thought about fleeing.
I mean, he did free his slaves.
He was not able to free all of them when he died because back then Virginia had a law, and this was the law that haunted Jefferson, and I write about this in my book. It'll be out in July. First of all, there was a law passed in the 1600s, and then there was a law passed in 1804 while Jefferson was president that was targeted at Jefferson. It was passed in Virginia. Jefferson had very little influence in Virginia while he was president, actually. In fact, his enemies had a lot of power. And this law said that Virginia resident freed a Virginia slave, and that slave had to, within 24 hours, leave the state of Virginia. And if they did not leave the state of Virginia, they would immediately be taken and sold at auction. And so both Jefferson at that point, if you wanted to free a slave, you not only had to pay to transport them outside the state, but you had to set up their life. Because there weren't, you know, if you just took them to the edge of the state of Virginia and let them go, you know, in North Carolina, I forget how the geography there, whatever the next state south is, there would be, you know, people there to snatch them and sell them in that state, right? So you would literally have to buy them a life.
a lot about Jefferson to me.
This is why he could never free his slaves. He could never, you know, he was smuggling all his money to Sally Hemings. All this stuff was going on. And the other thing was that another law that was passed during the time that Jefferson was president was said that if it was ever demonstrated that a slave owner had fathered a child by a slave, then that slave would be given to the local church for 2 years of hard labor and daily flogging. And then, after those 2 years, would be sold at public auction.
That's why he didn't sell Sally Hemings.
Well, he couldn't free her, he couldn't sell it. Neither of these guys could afford this. When George Washington ended his life on his deathbed, he did not have enough money to pay. He could only free 100 of his slaves, and there were still like 20 or 30 of them that he could not pay to relocate. And so, you know, he had to will them to somebody that he thought would take care of them. It was
and
a terrible, terrible situation.
Part of the agriculture
and these guys, and let me just finish this. These guys actually, you know, before, when the Constitution was being hammered out, I don't know if you know this, in the Constitution it says that as of 1808, there will be no more slave trade in the United States, no more importation of slaves into the United States. And Jefferson and Washington and many of these guys absolutely believed that the slave trade in the United States would be ended by 1808. And Jefferson in the early 1820s, and he was in a later life, you know, as he was an old man, he writes these anguished letters, which I've reprinted in Return to Democracy, which will be out in July. These anguished letters about how, you know, we failed. We thought we really believed we could end slavery. You know, I can't even end it in my own home here because of the laws that hem me in. And this is going to tear our nation apart. I see on the horizon a horrible civil war. I mean, he was predicting the civil war about slavery in the months before he died.
Who is this now?
Thomas Jefferson. In fact, the letter that he wrote is on the wall of the Jefferson Monument, where he says, when I reflect on these conditions, and he's talking about slavery, he says, I tremble to think that God is just. You know, and he's talking about, for my nation, I tremble to think that God is just. And, you know, the
I would love to read the letters between he and Adams written on the last few years of their life.
Oh, they're incredible. Well, for $40 on the Internet, you get a CD-ROM that has the collected works of Thomas Jefferson. There's a whole bunch of them out there. Different people are publishing them because it's all in the public domain. And you can just go through and do keyword searches. And I mean, 17,000 letters in there.
You picked the right hero. Tom, thank you.
Yeah, he's an amazing man. I gotta move along here, Roberta. Thanks for the call. I appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894. Kent in Houston, Texas is on the line. Hey, Kent, what's up?
My word. I guess I'm nervous now, but thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I can't tell you how much I enjoy your program, but two thoughts, you know, about General Myers.
Yeah.
One, the man told the truth. And in a time when there's so much lying and deception, I mean, I'd really like to see the man get credit.
Yeah, but the truth that he told was that he wasn't doing his job.
Oh, no, exactly right, sir. But, you know, also, if they could be held into account for the code when they were cadets,
yeah,
they will not lie, cheat, or steal, nor tolerate anyone who does. I mean, what a ratification that would be.
Yeah, he did better than Colin Powell did, ultimately.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because the man is so powerful.
Yeah.
Also,
Kent, that music means we got to take a break. If you want to make another point, I'd be glad to hold you on over the break.
Really?
Okay, hang on. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 10 minutes before the hour. You're in the Truth Arena. We'll be right back.
Are you frustrated by your constant inability to lose weight? Are you looking for a natural, clinically proven weight loss breakthrough? Introducing CarboBlocker. Unlike anything else on the market, CarboBlocker is backed by clinical research that proves it effectively helps block the fattening effects of carbs without stimulants. Your body will think you're eating a low-carb diet even when you're not. The results are simply amazing. If you want to maintain the weight loss effects of low-carb dieting for the long run, if you're tired of clothes that are too tight and you want to look fit and sexy, then CarboBlocker is for you. It's clinically effective formula is safe, natural, and stimulant-free. And as a special introductory offer, when you order two bottles of Carbo Blocker, you'll get two bottles of Appetite Blocker absolutely free. Call in the next 10 minutes, and you'll also receive two free books, Lose Fat Now and the Low Carb Cookbook, a $100 value, absolutely free. So call now, 1-800-743-5704. Guaranteed to work or your money back, so call now, 1-800-743-5704. That's 1-800-743-5704.
The founding fathers thought they'd stop corporations from ever overthrowing elected government. Little did they know that 200 years later, democracy would be stolen and twisted in the name of so-called conservative values. Hi, this is Tom Hartman. The founders of America fought the Revolutionary War against the excessive corporate power of the East India Company, and presidents from Jefferson to Eisenhower warned us that extremely big businesses could destroy democracy. You'll find this extraordinary American story in my book, Unequal Protection: The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. It starts with the Boston Tea Party and ends with the rampant corruption of the Bush administration. It tells the dramatic story of how corporations hijacked the Bill of Rights, setting the stage for the CEO takeover of America. And it shows how we can take America back, and tells the stories of Americans from Pennsylvania to California who are doing just that right now.
Unequal Protection is available in bookstores nationwide, and you can read several chapters online at unequalprotection.com. That's Unequal Protection by Tom Hartman.
Are you or a loved one making too many trips to the bathroom? Listen closely, because you're not alone. Over 30 million men suffer from an enlarged prostate. That's why if you make frequent trips to the bathroom, have urgency, hesitancy, or a diminished sex drive, then Super Prostate Formula is for you. It was designed by nationally recognized physician Dr. Michael Toplitsky. The results with his patients have been amazing. Reclaim control now and join the thousands of satisfied customers who have had incredible results with Super Prostate Formula. When you order two bottles of Dr. Toplitsky's Super Prostate Formula, you'll also get two bottles of his Super Libido Formula, an all-natural alternative to Viagra to enhance sexual vitality and performance, plus his book, Complete Guide to Prostate Health, and his newsletter, a total $100 value free as your gift. Guaranteed, or your money back. If you're not completely satisfied, return it for a full refund and keep his Libido Formula book and newsletter free as your gift. Not available in stores. Call now, 800-452-0978. 800-452-0978. That's 800-452-0978.
A virus that causes AIDS might throw some developing countries into social turmoil. I'm Steve Pomplin for Earthwatch Radio. Countries with large populations of HIV-positive citizens face years of social unrest and violence. That's the view of Robert Engelman, a vice president of the nonprofit group Population Action International.
HIV/AIDS really kills large numbers of people in the middle age population, and it leaves young people behind, so there's an even greater proportion of young people, sometimes called a youth bulge.
Engelman's group has found that countries with a youth bulge, large numbers of people between the ages of 15 and 29, are more prone to social conflict.
Our theory is that it changes the age structure in unprecedented ways. It's more the younger, middle-aged people who die from the disease. So the people who are dying of AIDS in a country that is really ravaged by this disease typically are in their most productive years. They're people in their 30s, people in their 40s, some people in their 50s. It artificially increases the youth bulge, which is something that we've documented is highly correlated with conflict.
Engelman says HIV/AIDS is hitting hardest in countries that already suffer from poverty and social unrest.
It artificially boosts the youth bulge that already exists in many of these societies, and it deprives the societies of leadership. And it just suggests that there's going to be increasing problems providing jobs, maintaining economic development, and keeping a stable society.
Engelman says more generous assistance in the fight against HIV/AIDS can help address the health of individuals and whole societies. Earthwatch Radio is a service of the Gaylord Nelson Institute and the Sea Grant Program at the University of Wisconsin.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Human beings want to be happy. We have a need not just to live, but to thrive.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 4 minutes before the hour. 12 state legislatures have passed legislation urging changes in the No Child Left Behind law. Just wanted to be sure and get that. And we were talking to Kent in Houston, Texas. Hey, Kent, you had another point you wanted to make.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I'm a Christian, and even though, I mean, the right wing seems to be so backed by the church, important to me, I mean, that Jesus didn't run for an office. and he was against that. They asked him to lead the revolution against Rome.
Well, in fact, he said, render to Caesar what's Caesar's and render to God what's God's.
And, you know, even though in the church, we're taught that being directly under authority of our leaders is being under authority to God. The leaders, of course, are human.
Well, also, it wasn't Jesus who said that. It was Paul.
Well, thank you. Yes, you're right. I am nervous.
And I think that there's a big difference. Paul, in my opinion, really took the church and steered it in directions that I frankly don't think Jesus would have agreed with. There was a huge split back then.
That's the whole thing, but the concept was founded on love.
Yeah.
And it was not founded on political activism. Yeah. And it's important, I think, for the church, to move back to the concepts of which we were founded and centered.
Yeah, and if you go back to Matthew 25, this is the one place in the entire New Testament where the disciples, not wanting to split hairs too finely here, but where the disciples came to Jesus and said, what do we have to do to get into heaven? How do we get into heaven? And Jesus said, here's how it's going to be in the last days. I'm going to be sitting there and I'm going to be separating the goats from the sheep. The goats are going to go to hell and the sheep are going to go to heaven. And it will be those people who fed me when I was hungry, who clothed me when I was naked, who visited me when I was in prison, who gave me water when I was thirsty. And they said, but we never saw you hungry. We never saw you thirsty. We never saw you in prison. We never saw you sick. And he said, as you do unto the least of these, my brethren, you do unto me. And,
thank you, because that's true.
That's the basis of liberal morality, in my opinion, Kent. That's the conservative moralists point to the Ten Commandments, the thou shalt nots. I prefer to point to Matthew 25, the thou shalts.
Yeah, legalism destroys your attitude on giving.
Yeah.
And you can only love through giving.
Yeah.
And you can only give by opening and giving out, and there would be no starvation. You know where I'm going with that.
Yep, I do. I do, and I absolutely agree with you.
Huh?
And I absolutely agree with you. And we're out of time.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
That's okay. Kent, thanks for calling. I appreciate it. It's great to hear from you. Great to hear from a listener. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Thanks to Louise for producing our show today. Thanks to Brad Walrod for helping with the music down in New York City. Thanks to Shelby and Ben. RadioPower.org and WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to Mike Toth for our archives at TomHartman.com. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Great conversations today. And thanks to you for listening. Tune in tomorrow, same time, same place. I'll see you here then.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Did you know that grapes are one of the most heavily sprayed of all agricultural products? Most people don't. But that is why it's so very important to drink wines that are made with certified organic grapes. And that is exactly what we are inviting you to do today. Taste our wines. We select them personally. They come from small properties in the south of France. They are delicious. Connoisseurs love them. And they are earth-friendly. My name is Véronique. I founded the Organic Wine Company in 1980 for people just like you. People who love wine and want to do well by our earth. Call us at 1-888-ECO-WINE. We'll answer all your questions. I look forward to talking with you. Call 1-888-ECO-WINE, and that is ECOWINE.